I've been fighting like a lion. Looks like I'm going to lose. Cause ain't nobody ever whipped the TB blues.
Hello, beautiful humans. I'm Tymie Castle.
And I'm Benjamin Mead.
And you're listening to Just a Minute. Just a Minute is an educational podcast where we break down justice topics in 30 minutes or less. Today's topic, the black nurses of Seaview Hospital. Nice. Hello, and thanks for joining us. Hello, Ben.
Well, hi there.
Hello, hello. Hi, guys. This episode today centers around a story that I just found out about, which intersects with my personal life in some very interesting ways, but also allows us to, you know, further discuss issues related to health equity and justice.
Yeah, this is a really different from what we've done before, but I really like it. I'm excited.
Yeah, me too.
To talk about it.
I liked throwing something completely different because I was going to talk about the ICC, which we'll do later, but this just kind of seemed a little bit more interesting to me today.
Yeah.
So we've discussed in previous episodes on ocean trash and climate justice that social problems, including health access and treatment, disproportionately impact citizens of the global south and in the U.S., low income and minoritized populations.
Right.
So let's begin by introducing tuberculosis, which is the focus of this episode. Ben, do you remember having a TB test as a child?
I don't know. I mean, I remember, you know, like getting shots, and I did have kind of like some major health scare when I was a really little kid. Oh. I had to have like a spinal tap and
Yeah,
it was really bizarre.
Yeah.
We were talking about this last time I was home.
Yeah.
And like the doctor didn't really know what was going on. I went and have a spinal tap. And then basically my mom said that, you know, like we came home from that and I went to sleep for like 2 days.
Oh, wow.
And then I woke up.
And was fine.
And I was like, Mom, I'm healed.
Oh, my goodness. That's so, and they never did really know weird. What the cause of that was.
No.
Oh, okay. So I'm allergic to penicillin, and I found out as a two-year-old when I was hospitalized and in a coma for that. So that was kind of a common thing in the late 70s, early 80s, is that children had allergies to penicillin. Mm.
Is the TB test, is that the one that has it's like the ring and all the little dots?
It's just a little bubble under your skin.
Oh, okay.
Because I was talking to Diane before I came over and she said she also had one. But I had one because I worked with children as a graduate student in Kentucky, and that was one of the requirements. But I first learned about TB as a child with discussions with my mother about her experience with it, because she almost died as a kid from tuberculosis meningitis.
Oh, gosh.
And the meningitis that was diagnosed from the spinal tap. So you mentioned spinal tap. That's kind of why I was wondering if it was meningitis related or anything.
I think maybe they thought it was, but the test came back negative.
Negative. Yeah. Okay.
They thought that was a potential diagnosis, but it wasn't.
Oh. Oh, well, now I'm glad you lived.
Yeah.
I'm glad my mom lived too, since I would never have been born.
Yeah, for sure.
But let's first give our listeners some information about TB, because I imagine that they probably don't think about it, haven't thought about it, and did not realize it's still an issue globally.
Yeah, no, I think about it as one of those things like measles that we just don't even worry about anymore, TB. Like,
except that measles are coming back.
Well, this is true. We talked about it in our anti-vax conspiracy episode.
Yeah,
but like somebody's, you know, like hacking or coughing, it's like either like, oh, it sounds like a TB ward in here or something like that. But some of this information comes from 2023 Global Tuberculosis Report by the World Health Organization.
Or WHO.
WHO, yeah. Mm-hmm. A stat that may surprise a lot of people is that in 2022, TB was the world's second leading cause of death from a single infectious agent. Obviously, I'm one of those shocked persons.
Shocked people.
Yeah. But second leading cause after COVID. And it caused almost twice as many deaths as HIV AIDS. So more than 10 million people continue to fall ill with TB every year.
Yeah, so hopefully, you know, that it tells you it's still a really serious problem, right?
Yeah.
So TB is caused by the Bacillus mycobacterium tuberculosis, and it's spread when sick people expel bacteria through, you know, coughing, just like with COVID. About a quarter of the global population is estimated to have been infected with TB.
You said bacillus. I've got a story about a bacillus.
Yeah.
So this is from when I was an undergrad in biology lab. In the lab teacher, she wasn't a PhD, but I think her last name was Miller anyway. She was mean. And she was like really intense. And I mean, I've always been like good at school.
Sure.
And really conscientious about my schoolwork. But my handwriting has always been quite sloppy.
Oh.
So anyway, we had to like, we were doing this lab work where we had to like look in the microscope and then like draw what we saw. So she was like walking by and looking at my work and like said this really loud in front of the class. You know, she's like, "Mr. Mead, what is that?" I was like, "A bacillus." And you know, I said like my handwriting is sloppy, so I didn't like completely connect the circle where I drew that. She's like, "That is not a bacillus. A bacillus does not have an open cell wall. You need to connect your circles." And I was like, like super embarrassed. But anyway, I was drawing a bacillus, and she was like making fun of my
That's a very bacillus. Cute story. That's a very cute story. I remember drawing paramecium. But anyway, following infection, the risk of developing TB disease is highest in the first 2 years. And some people actually just clear the infection. It typically affects the lungs, but can affect other sites as well.
Yeah, I had to look it up. Basically, it's like TB symptoms are basically the symptoms of a lung infection, what you would imagine, like coughing up blood, fever, sweat, chest pain. In my list of site that I was looking at, my favorite symptom last on the list was quote unquote not feeling well in general.
Which is a symptom of like everything. Just life these days, you know. But rattling in the chest. So without treatment, the death rate from the disease is very high, and treatment requires, you know, months of anti-TB drugs. And with drugs, about 85% of people with TB can be cured. My mom was one. So the WHO talks a lot about universal health coverage as really being like, you know, primary to ensuring that all people who need treatment for TB disease or infection can access the treatments. That's true of everything, right? But they also advocate for, you know, social determinants of health and correlates of getting TB that they also should be addressed, like things like poverty, undernourishment, HIV infection. Probably not surprising, as the global south bears the heaviest burden of TB infections, specifically 8 countries: India, Indonesia, China, the Philippines, Pakistan, Nigeria, Bangladesh, and the Democratic Republic of the Congo. And we actually have, you know, a largish Congo population in Harrisonburg through the refugee resettlement program. But today we're going to zero in on TB in the U.S., which now has one of the U.S. has one of the lowest rates in the world, right?
Yeah.
But cases have been rising since 2020 through, they're marginal compared to global rates.
Yeah.
But the highest rates are in Alaska, with more cases in California. Also, probably not surprising, the highest rates in the Black and Hispanic populations.
Alaska seems like a bizarre...
Actually, it was really high among Native Alaskan and Pacific Islander populations. Rates in those populations have actually decreased, but overall it's still increasing a little bit. So more than 80% of these are reactivations of latent TB rather than new cases, which is why there's no real fear of mass transmission. But we also have drugs, which I'll get to in just a minute.
Right. So we're talking about TB. You mentioned like your mom earlier. So what was your mom's experience with TB, and how does it relate to the
black
overall
nurses.
Black nurses?
So TB, as I said, is an infectious disease. It's highly contagious. My my mother's family was infected around 1955 or 56 when she was born. And all of the information that I have about her treatment and what happened to her is because the state TB sanatoriums kept very detailed records. So I have copies of her medical records.
Nice.
So kind of researching the sanatoriums, which I thought were super interesting, because we still have that building in Ashland where I grew up. And it's been like... you know, refurbished and utilized for a bunch of different things. Like it was once the state crime lab because it closed in the 70s. And now it's like permanent housing for domestic violence victims. So they just repurposed the building.
I was going to ask if it was abandoned because sanatorium, it sounds just like something that would be like abandoned and creepy.
Well, there's a very famous one in Kentucky called the Waverly Hill Sanatorium, and they do ghost tours there. So you, if you watch those shows, you might have seen it. So led me down the rabbit hole of researching these sanatoriums in the first half of the 20th century. And I read the story. It just came out this week in the New York Times, and I had like an OMG moment where I realized that the black nurses of Seaview Hospital in Staten Island, New York contributed to saving my mother's life.
Oh, wow. So the black nurses in New York came down to Kentucky? and like gave your mom?
No. Yeah. That's not really how it goes.
But did you know that the toothbrush was invented in Kentucky?
I did not.
Yeah. If it was invented anywhere else, it would be called the teeth brush.
I definitely heard that one before.
Yeah.
I forgot it, but, you know, yeah, I've heard
okay,
it. What else you got? Keep going.
Did you hear about the big fire that broke out in Frankfort in the Kentucky Capitol the other day?
No.
The governor's mansion caught fire?
Yeah.
Burned all the way down to the wheels.
I don't get that one.
It's like a trailer. Okay. the library caught on, the state library caught on fire too. But luckily the librarian was able to get out safely with all three library books.
Oh my God. Okay, I have not heard these. So you really dug deep for some of these Kentucky jokes, which I'm used to getting because I'm from Kentucky, especially when I moved to Pennsylvania.
And I know I've told you this one before, but you know what a Kentucky divorce and a tornado have in common?
No.
Either way, somebody's going to lose a trailer. So those are my favorite Kentucky jokes. But I grew up on the Kentucky line, but we were on the Virginia side, so we like to look down our nose.
Right. At the you have to have somebody to view as inferior.
Letcher County.
Yeah, Letcher County for sure. Got Letcher County. Okay, so they did not come down to Kentucky. So in contextualizing this a little bit, you know, TB heavily impacted low-income populations in the South. My grandfather was working class. He worked in the sanitation department for the city. Mm-hmm. And at the time, he and my grandmother had three children, with my mother being the youngest. So the records are like historical archives for my family as well, because the TB hospital had them get all of this information about the family home and income. And so I learned things like I wasn't born yet, but they had an electric fridge. Refrigerator and a gas range and no car, and their monthly net income from the sanitation department for my grandfather was $140 a month. So I looked up on an inflation calculator what that is today, and it's like $1,560 or something. I don't really think that's kind of equivalent, but anyway. Yeah, so part of this is like you need to know if the family can afford the meds. The fiscal court had some money set aside so that they could provide it, but I know that there are different reasons for why they probably couldn't access that. But anyway, he contracted TB, then my grandmother, and the records pick up when the family's being seen by specialists beginning in 1957 when my mother's 4 months old. So she begins getting x-rays, and they called them films in the records. So she's getting films every year.
Interesting.
So at some point over the next 6 months, she's
diagnosed. Did you know what that meant, or did you have to look it up?
Yeah, no, I knew what it meant. Because they talk about what they see on the film. So you know those are x-rays. I just in reading through these, I was like, oh my God, she got so many x-rays as a child. Like, why doesn't she have cancer yet?
Oh, yeah.
So then that unlocked a new fear. So that wasn't good. But she did get diagnosed and was prescribed isoniazid, which is how this story links to the episode topic.
Oh, okay.
So her condition improves somewhat, but also worsens. And they continue the med course. They reevaluate. But a visit in 1958, the doctor notes the meds were not given and that finances may be to blame. So he noted that, you know, they might want to seek out this money for treatment. So like many people who cannot afford life-saving medication, my family also had issues getting the medication regularly. They were doing rationing, I suspect, which is what a lot of people do. You ration the medication so you're not giving it consistently. There's a note in her file where my grandmother said they owed several thousand dollars. $100
Probably,
probably
thousands
today.
At the time.
Yeah. But she would buy meds if she had to beg for money. Like that quote is actually in the doctor's note. Yeah. So fast forward to 1960.
So like she's telling the doctor, like, I will pay for these meds even if I have to go out and beg.
Okay. Yeah. Gotcha. So 1960, and then my mom gets hospitalized with tuberculosis meningitis. She had presented at the hospital. My grandmother took her to the hospital because she was projectile vomiting, like all of the like really bad symptoms of meningitis plus tuberculosis. So before the medication was available in 1951, people who developed this typically died within 3 weeks.
Oh my gosh.
So basically the brain has now swollen from the long-term presence of the TB bacterium. So she was admitted at age 4 in the TB sanatorium in Ashland, Kentucky, where she was hospitalized for 257 days.
Oh my gosh, that's like almost a year.
And she's a child.
Yeah, 4 years old.
Yeah, yeah. So what just surprises me is that she remembers things, because I don't remember much from being four, mm-hmm. but I imagine this kind of experience, like mm-hmm. really, because she remembers like another person in there that she was telling me about, an 18-year-old who also had meningitis mm-hmm. and was in a crib. Mm-hmm. So she remembers like really weird things about the experience. Yeah.
I mean, this is kind of off topic, but speaking of that, like there are like maybe a handful of memories that I have like before I started kindergarten.
Yeah. They're like blips, but, mm-hmm. you know, like blips here and mm-hmm. there.
I remember it's almost like looking at a photograph. I remember one of them.
Right.
But another one. Yeah. I remember very vividly. I was like outside playing in this jet, like fighter jet, because I think they used to do, like the Air Force used to do training operations over Southwest Virginia. I think it had
interesting.
I think because the terrain was like similar to mountains. Like Central America, where they were having some like the CIA and Contras or something like that.
Okay, that makes sense.
And I was outside by myself, just in the yard, and this jet plane flew over, and it was so loud, and you know, I didn't know. It just scared me so bad. So I can remember that. But anyway, sorry. Back to being four.
Like it was almost her whole 4-year-old year.
Yeah.
And she remembers a lot of stuff. Mm-hmm. But also she really likes doctors and hospitals. And I think this is why, because she, rather than this being a really bad time for her, mm-hmm. I think she was taken care of very well in the hospital. Weirdly, she mm-hmm. likes doctors. Mm-hmm. So, you know, usually people,
I can see
I
that.
Mean, I like doctors, but I don't like love them. Like she loves going to the doctor. She loves being mm-hmm. hospitalized.
Yeah. Yeah. So, you feel like you're getting like taken care of and your needs met and you know, getting the like focus and the,
I imagine she was probably fawned over as being like a young child. Mm-hmm. There were also kids on, I just learned they were at the sanatorium. The doctors mm-hmm. lived there and their families lived there. So there were kids like looking up some of the sanatorium mm-hmm. abandoned stuff. Mm-hmm. There are people who comment like, I lived there in 1960s.
Oh my gosh. I didn't know that. Cool. That is, that's really interesting.
Yeah. We definitely got off on a side tangent, mm-hmm. but ultimately my mother recovered. Hello, I'm alive.
Thank goodness.
Because
for multiple reasons.
This podcast would not mm-hmm. exist because of the meds. But she was left with permanent brain damage and paralysis
from the meningitis.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So she also had to be tested every year for reactivation. So one of the interesting things I found was that her last one was in 1976, which was after I was born. So she was still mm-hmm. going for her yearly checkup until 1976.
Mm. Oh, wow. That's cool.
Yeah.
So, how did the black nurses of Seaview then relate to your mom in Ashland, Kentucky?
So now we're going to talk about isoniazid again. Mm-hmm. So Seaview was established in 1905, and by the 1930s, the TB infection rates were causing many white mm-hmm. nurses to flee, to quit.
So is Seaview like another sanitarium?
It's a hospital mm-hmm. in Staten Island, New mm-hmm. York, and it was opened in 1905, and mm-hmm. they put it kind of out there in Staten Island mm-hmm. away from the city on purpose. Mm-hmm. So the white nurses were fleeing and quitting because they did not want to risk their lives, you know, their lives caring for these patients. Mm-hmm. And so there's this New York Times article was about an exhibition now on view at the Staten Island Museum called Taking Care, the Black Angels of Seaview Hospital. Mm-hmm. So it tells the story of 300 black nurses who were recruited to mm-hmm. work there by the administration. And according to the curator of the exhibit, the name Black Angels came from patients and was embraced by the nurses. So the hospital first recruited black nurses locally from the Lincoln School for Nurses in the Bronx and the Harlem Hospital School of Nursing. But by the 1950s, Seaview still had a shortage. So the call for black nurses went national. Many of the nurses recruited were from the Jim Crow South, so it was during the Great Migration. Mm-hmm. They were promised a living wage when most hospitals, even in New York, refused to work with black mm-hmm. nurses or limited the number you could actually hire. Mm. So the exhibit honors the Black Angels for their major role in protecting the public.
Yeah.
The reason is that Seaview conducted the first clinical trials of isoniazid in 1951.
And that was, your mom was treated with that.
Yeah.
Now the connection emerges.
Yeah. So on the front lines of that trial were those nurses. Mm-hmm. They were the ones administering the medicine, observing the patients, and they were taking detailed notes, reporting that back to the mm-hmm. doctors. So they actually conducted mm-hmm. the research clinical trials on this drug. Mm. A panel of museum techs sums up what happens what happened next, which was the two doctors. I'm not even going to try to say their names. Besides, we're focusing on the black nurses and not the two white doctors, for male doctors. They oversaw the trial. They went on to receive the prestigious Lasker Award for their work, but the nursing and support staff who risked their lives have not received the same recognition.
Of course not.
So Dr. Oney Blackstock, the founder and executive director of Health Justice, which is a racial and health equity consultancy in New York City, said that the Black Angels were courageous trailblazers, and she saw definite parallels between them and the nurses who cared for dying patients early in the coronavirus pandemic. So she also said that we know that those hospitals that were most beleaguered during the pandemic were in poor Black and brown neighborhoods, and they were already under-resourced and understaffed. And it was Black nurses who couldn't afford to leave their jobs, and brown nurses, and they were the primary caregivers. So there's a book that was released last year by Maria Smilios called The Black Angels, The Untold Story of the Nurses Who Helped Cure Tuberculosis, that tells this story. And despite facing discrimination, you know, these nurses provided compassionate care to thousands of people with tuberculosis over decades and participated in those drug trials that ultimately led to the curing and treatment of the disease. So that is how the Black nurses of Seaview in New York helped save my mother's life.
Oh my gosh, that is so cool.
Isn't that a great story?
That's a great story. It's such an uplifting.
Again, for sure.
This is we've kind of pivoted a little bit recently and done some like good things. And this is definitely one of those kind of like uplifting and heartwarming stories of justice.
I like that we're stepping away from the system for a while.
Yeah, the doom and gloom.
Well, not long, because I'm going to cover the ICC, but we'll be back.
Well, I guess that's it then.
Yes.
So that means it's our Minute to Spin It, where we each give our takeaway from today's episode. So Tommy, in just a minute, what's your spin?
So in all countries, whether low, middle, or high income, there are wide disparities in the health status of different social groups. The lower an individual's socioeconomic position, the higher the risk of poor health, and not just from TB, but all diseases.
Sure.
Health equity is a social justice issue and is defined as a state in which everyone has a fair and just opportunity to attain their highest level of health. Achieving this, however, requires ongoing societal efforts to address historical and contemporary injustices, overcoming economic, social, and other obstacles to health and health care, and eliminating preventable health disparities. So that was my serious spin.
Yeah.
Here's my funny one.
Okay.
Even though my mother doesn't listen to podcasts, so she won't hear this, but even if she did, she has a great sense of humor and she would find it very funny.
For sure.
So this is a doctor note from 1969 and my mother's 12, and it says, quote, "The size of the chest has markedly increased since the previous study," and he wasn't referring to her lungs.
Oh my gosh. So she was just blooming and blossoming like a young country Kentucky flower.
Yeah. It's so funny because, you know, they probably did that for like clinical reasons.
Yeah.
Like, 'cause she was getting x-rays and films each time, but it was just like markedly increased the size of the chest. And they didn't use breasts.
Hubba hubba. In his nose anywhere or anything.
No. So Ben, what's your spin?
He wouldn't work in an iron lung, mate. So that was an attempt to do an Australian accent.
Okay.
But that's like a saying in Australia. So like a common saying, like he wouldn't work in an iron lung. And that's basically a way to say that somebody is like super lazy. So an iron lung, that was the thing that was used to treat TB and polio. And it's basically like this big metal like vacuum chamber that you lay in, and it, you know, like the vacuum
breathes for you,
blows air up into your face essentially, and is essentially breathing for you. So basically the, you know, Australian saying means, you know, like he wouldn't work in an iron lung means like you're too lazy even if somebody's breathing for you. But that kind of reminds me of like a lot of old you know, Appalachian sayings, and you were talking about like your papaw and stuff. Do you know any good old Appalachian words or sayings?
They're not safe for the podcast.
Oh, well.
The only ones that come to mind right now are not safe for work.
Oh, gotcha. I think about like words that like kyarn or gom.
Yeah.
Which I heard people say kyarn, like, oh, that's kyarny.
Well, you know, we have words in Kentucky that don't exist anywhere else.
Well, yeah, like these.
Like buggy, like cart. Yeah. Like I had to explain to people when I say buggy, I mean cart. And when you look at toboggan, which is a hat in Kentucky, it actually says hat in Kentucky as part of the definition. So we have those weird words.
We said toboggan in Virginia, too. And we said buggy for carts, too.
So, so you're not as superior to Kentucky as you Southwest Virginians think you
are. Well, no, we say the same thing. I mean, we're like 10 feet away.
Yeah,
so
that's true. True.
It's just the arbitrary state line
it is.
That divides us and not our slang and sayings.
Yes.
But I thought you did a really good job with your kind of like serious spin. So I'm just going to kind of skip my concluding remarks. But I did also find a song. So Jimmy Rogers, you know who Jimmy Rogers is?
I do not. Yeah.
He was like contemporary with the Carter family.
Oh,
so like kind of like Jimmy Rogers and the Carter family were kind of like the precursors to what we know as country music.
Yeah.
Right now.
And he, from Virginia.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
The Carter family was.
The Carter family. I don't know.
Jimmy, he might have been Tennessee or maybe even farther south.
But the Carter family.
Yeah. But he was kind of like the Elvis or the Hank Williams of his day.
All right.
Jimmy Roger Ross.
Okay.
And he has a song that's actually called the TB Blues.
What?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It says, I've been fighting like a lion. Looks like I'm going to lose. Because ain't nobody ever whipped the TB Blues. I've got the TB Blues.
That's good. What year did that come out?
I mean, he was like in the 20s, I think.
Oh, okay. Yeah, it was definitely before.
But it may even be older than may have been because like an old standard or something.
Now I'm gonna go look up the lyrics to the rest of that song.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There's like a lot of them. I just picked some of the.
There's a lot of songs. There are a lot of songs about TV.
Oh, a lot of lyrics. I mean, there's like five or six different verses.
Okay, that was good. Anyway, I liked it.
TB Blues. No more TB Blues, thanks to the Black Angels.
We are a community-driven podcast sponsored by the Gandhi Center and produced by JMU Libraries. Please check out our website linked in show notes to see how you can support our educational programming.